is the ecosystem service valuing. And I'll say at the outset, this is an informational item. and we appreciate your coming back on this. You can start. Just reference him
Chair Iveson, members of the Board of Forestry, and we'll forget Peter. my name is Brandon Ketzel, the economist for the department. This is, as Chair Iveson said, an informational item, and we're bringing this back after the November 2018 meeting in which Dr. David Lewis, who's here with us again, and Dr. Randy Rosenberger joined us and talked about ecosystem services. And in that first discussion, David briefly went over what are ecosystem services to help us wrap our mind around what exactly these things are that we keep referring to, and then how do we quantify and value ecosystem services. And so he led us through an example at the time, a base example of a way to value ecosystem services at the time. And at the end of it, the direction we got from the board was to come back one more time and to talk about an actual framework for how this could be done as an agency and how it's done in academia, how these studies are done. So we asked Dr. Lewis to come back and join us again and to talk about a framework about ecosystem services and how that could be applied. But also, I met with David and Randy 2 weeks ago, and one of the other things we talked about was beyond just going over a framework that's been used, actually trying to give us a recommendation as we think about this and how we can apply it in our own work and something to wrap our minds around at a more fundamental level. So one of the things David has prepared for us also at the end is an actual idea for something for us to think about as we go into possibly your October retreat. So I'm going to hand this over to David and let him go. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Iveson, State Forest Authority, and members of the board. Thanks for inviting me back. Good to see you all again. So today I want to follow up on my previous discussion back in November, go into a little more depth and provide a specific example related to Oregon, hopefully to give you a better sense of how these things are done in academia, and then end with an idea for how we could move forward. There we go. Thank you. Helps if I turn it on. Okay, so ecosystem services. When we think about ecosystem services, these are known as benefits that people derive from functioning ecosystems. So last time I presented this particular slide, so this is going to be my only reminder from what I did last time. Just as some examples to get your head around some ecosystem services on Oregon timberland and how we think about them. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment sort of defined ecosystem services in terms of provisioning, regulating, cultural or supporting, and just as some examples of these on Oregon timberland. Provisioning ecosystem services, we could think about Douglas fir, trees for timber, so timber is an ecosystem service. Regulating services, things like carbon sequestration. Cultural services, things like mountain bike trails, things that people like myself like to do in forest land. Supporting services, habitat for wildlife would fall into this particular category. And so how might you think about using ecosystem services in making your decisions? So here's kind of an overall framework that I want to go through first, and then I'll dive into a particular example about one element of it, which you might not be as familiar with. So if we think about the top there, where we have rules and decisions, like you all have just been debating for the last hour and a half, and we think about these things generating changes, some change in timber management, such as, for example, change in riparian management. This can lead to then a change in forest ecosystems, which can then affect ecosystem services. And the link between forest ecosystems and ecosystem services, we think about as coming through an ecological production function. So for example, you may have a change in riparian management that gives you more salmon, right? And so there's a production function that translates the change in ecosystems to ecosystem services. And then going around this circle here, ecosystem services, then why we are interested in them is because there are things that people benefit from. And so you can think about quantifying the degree to which people benefit from ecosystem services. And in economics, we have a series of valuation methods trying to get at this, trying to quantify these preferences. So for example, you can think about benefits from more salmon, you can think about costs from foregone timber production, or if the change was the other way around, it could be benefits from more timber production or cost to salmon, or perhaps they could both be benefits. And so there are methods that we're going to use to value these ecosystem services. And I'm going to go through an example of one of them in just a minute. And then how might the board use these? And so how we think about this whole framework in academia is that once you have values of ecosystem services, this generates a set of benefits and costs, rules and decisions. And in an ideal world, these benefits and costs, you could look at them for, say, different segments of society. You could break them down and think about distributional concerns, or you could look at them as an overall metric of benefits and costs, right? Think about net benefits, for example, of a particular policy or rule change. Or you can also think about a series of alternative rules and looking at the net benefits associated with each of them. So this is kind of one overall framework for how we sort of think about ecosystem services in academia. And what I want to do next is I want to zero in on number three. Right, because I think this is probably the area that I have the most comparative advantage to, at least professionally. I'm an environmental and resource economist, so this is kind of that's my particular specialty. And it's just from listening to your discussion, it sounds like you're quite familiar with some of the others. So I'm going to take those as a given right now and focus more on number three. So let me show you an example, and this is an example from ongoing research right now from a project that I have been leading. This is with two other economists at OSU, Steve Dundas and David Kling, as well as Daniel Liu at NOAA and Sally Hacker, an ecologist at OSU. And what we have been working on the last couple of years is estimating the non-market value of more Oregon coast coho. A challenge with estimating how the public would benefit from, say, more coho arises because these benefits are often non-market. So these are benefits that are not traded in markets. When it comes to recovering endangered and threatened species, the one thing that this particular literature has shown over many years is that a lot of the values that people derive from improving prospects of threatened and endangered species is independent of their use of the species. So it's not tied necessarily to whether people, say, go fishing or whether people even eat these species for dinner. Right. So a lot of these values are non-use. And so hence, there's no market prices that we can look at that would reveal the public's willingness to pay for changes in the species. Okay, so this is a particular challenge. And so what we typically do in these cases in economics, in environmental economics, is we work with what are called stated preference methods. So if people are not revealing their preferences in any way through their behavior in markets, then we have to go to them directly. And so one of the handouts is the survey that this study is based on, right? So this was a mail survey that was sent out in fall of 2017. I'm going to walk you through a couple of the key ideas associated with the survey, but you can have these copies and you can fill it out if you want. I won't put you in the data set because you're not quite a part of our random sampling strategy, but for your own enjoyment. Okay, so basic steps in conducting these particular studies. So this is known as a choice experiment, and it is an experiment, right? The first thing to emphasize that you are doing with these is you are trying to value a change in an ecosystem service. You're not trying to value, say, the standing stock of a particular service. You're trying to value a change. So if you tie it to your decision-making, so if you make a rule change, for example, that leads to some changed ecosystem service, what we're interested in here is valuing a change. So the way that we set these surveys up is we typically define a status quo of a particular service, whatever that may be. And in this case, for this particular species, our status quo, we looked at the current long-run average number of returning adult coho to Oregon streams, as has been kept track by ODFW over the years. And then what you want to do is value a change. And so ideally, when you're designing a survey, you want the change to be based on the best available natural science that there is. And so what we used was the state of Oregon's Oregon Coast Coho Conservation Plan, which has a series of stated goals in there that relate to ocean conditions. And so we took the long-run average of past ocean conditions and translated those goals to an upper bound number, which is on this graph here. It's about 525,000 returning fish, whereas the current long-run average is around 150,000 fish. And so you can think about this is important with these studies is what is you're trying to value, right? So one of the things that we're trying to value is this type of a change. The next thing that you do in these studies, after you've figured out the type of change that you're interested in valuing and the particular service that you're interested in valuing, so this particular study is focused on Oregon Coast Coho and that alone, is to inform survey respondents about the ecosystem service. Because you're going to ask them to state preferences associated with changes in these services. So the first step with these studies is to inform them about the service. So if you look at this survey that was handed out, this is a 16-page survey. This is a bit meaty for a survey. This is pushing the upper bound. This is pretty common for this literature in terms of the size of these. But about the first 8 pages of the survey is background information, this is supposed to be presented in an unbiased manner to educate respondents about this particular service, in this case about Oregon Coast Coho salmon, its status, its current population trends, some of the management actions that have been proposed to improve the species, right? So that's about the first 8 pages of that. Then you get to the heart of the survey. And so this is known as a choice card. And this is what the survey is centered around. And you can see one on page 10 of your survey. All right? And actually page 10 and page 11 and page 12 have 3 different versions of the same choice card. So the idea with this is an experiment. And what you're doing is you're defining attributes associated with this experiment. And so we have a set of attributes here in terms of the population status. This is its ESA recovery status, the population size, population over time, some recreational fishing regulations. And then importantly, this is where the economics of this really comes in, is a cost to your household associated with different management actions, right? And so the idea of these is then to include scenarios that are changes in the ecosystem service. So if you look at this one I have on the screen, for example, you see the first column there is labeled status quo. This is our baseline. Right? And this sort of is meant to give respondents a sense of where we are right now with this particular species. And then the second 2 columns are 2 sets of alternatives, and they differ in terms of the attributes, whether the population is recovered, its size, the speed that it changes over time, recreational fishing, and then cost to your household, right? And so what survey respondents are asked to do is to pick which alternative they prefer. An important part of this, why this is an experiment, is the design of this. We call this the experimental design, right? Is if you flip across the 3 choice cards, you'll notice that the numbers differ across all 3 in terms of the scenarios, the cost numbers, the levels of the different attributes. And if you look at the persons next to you, you'll notice that your cards differ from theirs, right? So what we do is we generate experimental variation here that differs both within a survey and across surveys, right? And so what that gives us is a set of responses of people choosing, of stating their preferences for which of these that they prefer with a wide variation in terms of these different attributes. And then what we're trying to do is take that variation and take people's choices and try to tease out how much they're willing to pay for changes in these individual attributes. This comes from looking at many choices that people are making in our survey, not from any one particular survey, but once you look at them all together.
What's your sample size?
This particular survey, actually, it's right here. We have 926 unique households that answered this, and we have 2,734 choice card responses from this. They didn't all answer all 3, but most of them did.
Oh, so each one gets all 3.
Yep. And so that's the data that you can think about is we have 2,734 individual responses, right, that came from this. And that's what we're using then. So we analyze this data with what are called econometric methods. This is sort of fancy statistics applied to economic data, essentially. And the idea with this is to take all of these, how people are making these choices, and trying to estimate the mean household willingness to pay scenarios would have improvements in the ecosystem service. And so in this case, it's changes in coho, Oregon Coast coho. So some preliminary results from our study are as follows. So here, I just pulled out a couple just to give you a flavor of what comes out of this. I say preliminary. This paper is currently under review right now, so it's in revision stage, and so peer review will be done quickly. But I can give you, if I'm comfortable giving you a flavor of some of the results. So for example, if you thought about a scenario where the species remained threatened, did not come off the ESA, Endangered Species Act, but it improves over time by an average of 100,000 more fish per year. And the speed of population change is slow. The average willingness to pay is about just under $60 per year per household, $59.75. And there's a confidence interval there. I pulled out another scenario to give you a sense of more of the upper bound part of this. And so if the species is recovered with more fish, say 375,000, and it happens quickly, then the mean willingness to pay per household is $179.19 per year, right? So what you can do with these types of studies then is you can look at willingness to pay for different changes, right, in this particular species. So you could focus on lots of different changes in, say, the population size. One thing I'll have you note here that's an interesting finding is even if the species does not come off the Endangered Species Act, what our study shows is that there's still substantial non-market economic benefits that the public holds from having more fish, from at least improving their status. The next step with these is how do you aggregate these numbers to a population of interest? There's many ways to do this. There's lots of challenges with this. I'm just going to show you the cleanest way here that is known as a lower bound approach. This is not the final word on this, but just to give you just a flavor of how these numbers might add up. So in this case, the lower bound uses the response rate to the survey, which is about 21% in this case, and indicates that that's the proportion of the population that has a non-zero willingness to pay and assumes everybody else is zero. This is probably not true. That's why I call this a lower bound. Right? So this gives you kind of, but it gives, sometimes a lower bound is useful to kind of think about at the bottom end, what would you get? So if we define the population, as we did in this example, we use the Pacific Northwest region. This was where we sent the survey to. This includes the general population of Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Northern California, which we defined as Bay Area up. So you include that particular region and aggregate up to that. These are the numbers that you get. This household willingness to pay numbers would go up to $107 million per year for that first scenario that I mentioned. Species remains threatened. 100,000 more fish happen slowly. The more optimistic scenario, where the species is recovered with more returning fish, 375,000 more fish, about $321 million per year. This is a lower bound because this assumes that almost 80% of the population has zero willingness to pay. So, but it's interesting to look at this even under that assumption that the numbers are quite large in this case. And this is not uncommon with these studies of endangered and threatened species in the sense that the benefits that you get from improving endangered and threatened species tend to be very diffuse and tend to occur very broadly, right? And this is partly because of the non-use aspect of benefits that people derive from this. And I'll say at the bottom that a good upper bound estimate accounts for the sample selection bias associated with who chose to return the survey. Ours is in progress right now. So it's part of our peer review process. Should be done pretty soon, but I'm not ready quite yet to share those. But the upper bound will be higher than what.
So responding, so you had a 21% response rate to your survey.
Yep.
And did you know the attributes of the individuals that you were sending them to? So you had prior knowledge or you could look for sample selection bias.
That's part of what we're doing.
And it's a 21% return rate reasonable for these kind of surveys? I mean, this is kind of what you expect with a
very
16. Yeah. So
yeah, it's very common nowadays for this. Essentially, before we sent it out and we were doing testing of sort of what kind of variation we needed in our experimental design, 20% was the number we used as our expectation going in. Right. Very common now. These are 16-page surveys, and it's not that's a very common response.
And so did you buy your information to find out who you were sending it to? I was just curious.
Yeah. So we tried a couple of methods. We did a pilot where we just used mailing addresses from the post office, and we got a much lower response rate in that because we didn't have names. And then we ended up using a firm that collected data on where to name the person when we sent it to them, and that improved response rate. So that's what we went to at the end. And so we do know information about people that returned the survey and that didn't return the survey. So that's partly what we're working on right now in terms
Great.
Of the bottom part, which is its whole other issue
yeah.
besides the survey itself. Yeah. So with these particular approaches for valuing changes in ecosystem services, and when I say valuing, I mean the following, is what we're doing here is we're trying to measure people's values, right? So that's the purpose of this particular study and methods like this. These stated preference methods are the only method used for services that have non-use values. So if you're working on something where the change of service is an endangered or threatened species, this is your method, essentially. Other services like recreation, there are approaches you can use where you can use people's revealed behavior rather than these stated preference approaches. So it depends, which method you use depends on what service you're trying to value. Implementing these methods requires, I would say, highly specialized skills. In terms of if you're thinking about doing these things, these are not easy to do. And conducting an original study takes time and money. So just to give you a sense of this particular one, so I led the work on this particular study with our team. We commenced it in the winter of 2016. It went into the field in the fall of 2017. And right now it's in revision at a journal, hopefully be published by the end of the summer of 2019, just to give you kind of a timeline of roughly how long these things take. If you were to design and run it, or if you were to add, let me rephrase that. If I were to run another choice experiment like our coho study, I would say it would probably cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $200,000 to $300,000 altogether, just to give you kind of a rough ballpark of what it takes to conduct these. And then finally, ideally, the valuation exercise that we've done here is paired with an ecosystem service production function. And why is that useful? Because if you have a nice production function, you can then translate, say, a rule change or some decision to a specific change in the number of fish, which then you could translate into this. And we have a thing about this, the price per fish that you can generate from this.
Are you going to end up with like a continuous demand function out of your survey, or is it more categorical?
No, actually, it's going to be it's not quite a continuous demand function, but okay. What it is it's at the end we have implied discount rates that people are discounting future coho at, if you like present value calculations,
okay.
associated with basically a per fish per year type estimate.
Okay,
and so the advantage of that is then you can price any particular change from a real marginal change in numbers of fish to a much larger change. And that's really what you're aiming to do here, is to generate a valuation method that allows you some flexibility. So that if you have, say, a small change, that you can value that. So if you, say, convert a few farms into salt marshes, mm-hmm. you could take value what that would be, or a big change. So the idea with these is try to make them as flexible as possible. At least that's what we tried to do. So here's my idea then for the board to consider. I know you're interested in using ecosystem services in some way to make decisions. So I've thought about this a little bit, and I was inspired by China's gross ecosystem product, which is in the works, and I saw a seminar on a few weeks ago. So this is somewhat inspired by that. And so one way you might think about moving forward is to invest in knowledge for a small subset of ecosystem services that may be affected by board rules and decisions. And I'm not sure what those are. I suspect salmon is probably one of them, given what I've heard, but you might think of others too. With ecosystem services, you can quickly expand to many things, the problem can explode. And so what I'm suggesting here is potentially to focus a little bit on, say, a small set that's more manageable. I'm not sure the exact number. I threw out 3 to 5. It's just an example. I suspect you already do timber quite well, but some of the others may be able to add some value to it. And by original knowledge specific to Oregon forests, I mean ecological production functions, economic valuation functions. You really ideally need both of those things, and it helps if they're coordinated. Then what could you do with this information? Well, I mean, to me, I think you could draw on this knowledge as needed over time. It could be updated potentially over time, as things change, new knowledge comes out. And as I said, this is actually what China is doing in terms of they're trying to create what's called the gross ecosystem product, which is This is the GEP, which is similar to the GDP, if you know that. So they're thinking about the environmental equivalent to GDP. And basically what they've done is they've narrowed down to a set of ecosystem services, and they're pricing them and monitoring the quantity changes with them and then translating them into dollars so that they can use that along with GDP on a nationwide scale. But I think a lesson from them is they've chosen just a small subset rather than to try to think about everything possible. Several of them are related to water quality. Those are because they have some, my understanding is the pricing data of water is much better over there. And so it's an easier one for them to do. But they've got multiple related to water quality. So that is my idea. And just, this is that same slide before. And I'll end there and open up for any questions that people have.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It seems like, you know, it makes me think about democracy, and I wish, you know, when we voted for candidates, you know, they could be representing just one issue. and I can see why China needs it. You know, without democracy, this is one of the few ways they can get feedback. Thank you, Rim.
So did you develop a ecological function, production function for salmon, by the way?
Not myself.
Yeah.
I'm an economist. I'm going to stay in my wheelhouse there. But I will say that I am working with some ecologists who are trying to do that and trying to coordinate with this. It's not done yet. And I'm sort of peripherally on the side there in recognizing that they have the expertise on that rather than me. But yes, that we are trying that. Yes.
And because we were in the riparian rules, that's what we really found. I mean, we could have thought about trying to evaluate or use benefit-based transfer studies, but we couldn't get an agreement on what the results would be from the riparian buffer and the change, certainly not around change in fish. It was, and you know, we had surveyed scientists by, you know, and it was all over the map in terms of an agreement. So that's one of the challenges, is producing those at the margin, those ecological function, production functions.
Agreed, yeah. And so one possibility you might also think about is that even if you don't have full agreement on one, if you have ways to generate alternative scenarios, right, in terms of kind of a worst case, a best case, you can potentially at least put bounds on what these things might be.
Yeah.
The information that you've got, I guess, in print or in press, rather.
Yeah. In review.
In review. Obviously, you were drawing from a broader geographic area. Is there any reason to believe that if it passes review and gets published, that that information would not be applicable to our decision-making in Oregon? You know, did we have different willingness to pay in Oregon than Washington and Idaho and wherever else you were drawing from?
So the numbers that I showed you are aggregated to the whole Pacific Northwest. And I would say that the idea with these studies is to present information such that you can aggregate in lots of different ways, depending on whose benefits you want to think about considering. With these types of non-use values, you can be quite broad, but maybe there's a reason why you'd only be interested in, say, the benefits to Oregon alone. And so then you just aggregate to a different number than you would from, say, a broader sense. And these studies are designed to be able to be aggregated in different ways, depending on the population of interest that you have. And so the survey itself was sent to people from those four states. And so we have preference. You can think about the results that we have are preferences that are elicited from people in those, in all those states. And it was a random sample to all states. So it's a general population survey rather than targeted to, say, just anglers or anything. It's a general population survey. So that gives us a lot of different ways you could aggregate up to things. That's a good question. And so when we sent the survey out, we stratified, we sent more to Oregonians than the rest. And so we've looked at whether there are differences in across those, and they're almost the same. And it's actually, that's not inconsistent with past evidence around these types of non-use values, because if you think about if you can derive benefits without direct interaction, you don't have to necessarily be right next door to this particular species to benefit from it. And this is true with a lot of endangered and threatened species. That's why I say these benefits can be quite diffuse. So if you really want to try to measure them, you want to try to broaden out your scope a little bit. But for any particular decision-making process, you may be interested in, say, aggregating to a smaller population. And that's, you can do that with this type of information.
I was just going to ask, what degree do you think willingness to pay might be changed if the people filling out the form were faced with a choice between species? So in other words, they're willing to pay a certain amount to keep coho or get more, but how much would they be willing to pay if it was coho and, I don't know, Pacific yep. Martin, for instance?
Good question. So one way to think of what we, one of the things we do in this survey is you try to tell people in the information beforehand about other types of threatened and endangered species. So they think about making choices conditional on the knowledge that there might be other things out there. Right? But that said, I can't measure specifically how this would change if, say, there was a joint program with another one. But there are a couple studies out there that have, one of my collaborators on this paper, Dan Liu, wrote a study where they had a survey that had multiple different types of salmon in there. And so it could kind of tease out how those values differed. And I can't remember off the top of my head the results of that, but there is some evidence out there about that. That study was much different, though. They only valued changes in recovery status rather than what we're doing here is trying to get the more marginal values. And that's novel in this particular study is trying to get at the more marginal values. So I can't fully answer that, but I will say that part of the best practices in designing studies is to inform people about other types of species out there.
Informing them is one thing, having them pay for something is a bit different, right? So if I have a certain amount of money I'm willing to pay to try to recover a set of species, then I have to start making choices about what I'm going to spend on one versus one the other.
So in economics, the way we think about this is that if you think about back to first time you saw economics, you think about a demand curve. And a demand curve is there in the context of other things that people might pay for, right? When you look at any particular demand curve, you're not sort of saying how something else might change at the same time. You're just looking at that demand curve in isolation. And that's kind of one way to think about this. Is it similar to getting one particular demand curve given our current set and given the current things that people pay for? So we call it ceteris paribus. So all else
equal. Things equal.
Yeah.
So just looking at the way your choice cards were set up, it seems like you were looking at trying to gauge a willingness to pay based on the assumption that we could employ some restoration project as opposed to a trade-off with other beneficial uses.
Yeah.
Have you done any similar kind of work where rather than this sort of amorphous restoration project that could occur without changing anything else was instead designed to, so we could, you know, are you willing to pay for an increase in salmon if it's paired with a reduction in timber, for instance, which is really the kind of choices that we at the board are most often faced with.
Yeah.
Where does that...
So the way these studies are designed is not to ask people to act as if they were on the board, right? And so one of the important things about these is that there are costs, right? And that's part of the choice cards, right? It's a major attribute of cost. And people, you know, when you run models on these, that cost attribute behaves in the way you'd expect, that all else equal, if that cost is higher, people are much less likely to pick a restoration scenario. So one of the ways that you're asking about some of the costs associated with programs, and that's the way that they're dealt with in these studies, is that there's a cost variable in there, attribute we call it, and people are asked to consider that when making these particular choices, right? But they're not asked specifically about, say, trading off something in timber versus salmon.
So the cost element here that I see sort of the trade-off was relative to recreational fishing, which is in the same, you know, arena. So, you know, in some of these, the fishing was periodically closed and some it was open every year. There were some where you had changes in the number of fish that you could catch. that's a willingness to pay on trade-offs within the same topic. What I'm wondering is, have you looked anywhere you set it up where the trade-off factor related to something, some other type of beneficial use?
So all you can do in a study like this is you can look at trade-offs within all of the attributes that are embedded in your survey. Yep. Okay, so I've showed you one way to think about willingness to pay is basically trading off cost and a change in a particular program. You could also look at trade-offs between, say, more fish and recreational fishing. Mm-hmm. Right? You could look at more fish and recovery status. You can do any changes within the attributes you have, but that's a limit here in the sense you can only look at trade-offs that are within the choice card that you have. So if you want to look at trade-offs between, say, something in CoHo and something else, you would need to design the survey so that you had that other attribute in there and people were asked to consider that. So
I guess the question was, have those kinds of attribute cards been developed and done? And
not with salmon, but with other things. Yeah. Yes. So a lot of the stated preference work like this that are related to ecosystem services, a lot of them, one of the things that they tried to do is take multiple different types of ecosystem services and put them on one choice card. Mm-hmm. And I sort of have mixed opinions about that because it's hard for people to get their head around, like, say, seven really different ecosystem services that might come about. But on the other hand, you can start to get at those trade-offs between different types of ecosystem services if that's what you're interested in. Yep. What our goal here was to try to get at, you know, changes, people's willingness to pay for small changes in particular population or big changes in particular population. And so hence it was a more focused survey, but you can design these in different ways. And you can design these with multiple ecosystem services. You could design them like this one, which is more focused on one. So there's lots of flexibility associated with these. Yeah. But it does limit you. You know, you design it and you're stuck with then whatever trade-offs you can make or come from the design that you set up. Mm-hmm.
Would this or would it not be a useful tool in terms of extinctions?
People have used them in the past for it in order to get at the losses associated with extinction. This particular study, we did not have that as a change. So I'm not sure how you would, I don't think I would use these numbers necessarily to get at an extinction scenario for this particular species, but you could. The method is flexible enough where you could do that.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. We do have a public comment. Jim James.
Chair Imanson, State Forester Doherty, and the rest of the Board of Forestry. My name is Jim James. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. And I'd like to add support for the concept of recognizing the ecological values protected in Oregon's forest with forest practice laws. I believe landowners embrace protecting these values when there is scientific justification for the protection measures needed. The greatest contribution to protecting ecological values is maintaining forests as forests. Oregon's land use laws alone do just that, protecting those forest values. Keeping forests as working forests is essential for landowners to be motivated to keep their forests as working forests. Overly regulated forests, particularly if the regulations are not scientifically justified, is a menu for conversion to other more economically viable uses. Oregon's forest practice laws are supported by the landowner community, primarily because they're based on science. I believe the landowner community will support any forest practice rules where science justifies the need for those changes. I believe most people recognize that these ecological values protected by the forest practice laws are basically free to the public. But seldom does landowners receive any recognition for that contribution. And in fact, it's interesting that the current legislature is trying to find ways to charge landowners more for the services that they provide. Landowners gladly pay their fair share in the costs of forest regulations and in fire protection, but it is ironic that the legislature often wants to charge us more. One way the public could pay their fair share is to add more general fund dollars to the forest practice rules and to fire protection. I hope that the board recognizes forest landowner contributions to these important ecological values, and when particularly when evaluating possible regulation changes. And it's important that you use real credible science before you make any regulatory changes. And one question I might ask in a similar survey would be, would you be willing to personally write a check every year for those benefits? Because I can tell you, forest landowners do every year write that check for the ecological values that the public is receiving, and hope you take that into consideration when you're proposing new rules. Thank you.
Okay, any questions?
Jim, not quite related to this, but you mentioned some news about a topic that the board has heard about, which is the legislative concept that the Committee of Family Forest Land worked on.
Yeah, and I'd be pleased to report to the board. If you recall, I think it was the last board meeting, we talked about House Bill 2469. That was a bill introduced by OSWA to allow a second dwelling on forest property where there was already an existing dwelling for a family member to help that forest landowner manage their forest. OSWA's motive for that bill was succession planning. We have a lot of members who have family members that are disassociated with their forest land, but would like to live on the property with their parents, and making that opportunity available certainly helps in succession planning. It passed the House by a vote of 56-2. It passed the Senate 28-0. And it's my opinion that the governor will likely sign it. There were only two people opposed to it in both houses. So, and I would like to give some credit to the Family Forest for Oregon and the Department of Forestry. This concept was originated in that board committee, and there was a lot of work done to help it. And Kyle Abraham, I'd like to thank you to him. He was helpful in setting up our meetings with 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and working through some of the challenges and differences that we had to find some solutions that fit for everyone. And there is some criteria there for fire protection. The house, the new building has to be fire safe, has to be in a rural fire district. And so we believe we've addressed all the issues that folks were concerned with. So Department of Forestry, thank you.
Pretty good vote.
Thank you.
So this, I want to thank everybody for their participation today. The board will now have an executive session pursuant to ORS 192.660.2F and H for the purpose of conferring with legal counsel regarding information that is exempt by law from public inspection and the board's rights and duties related to current litigation or litigation likely to be filed, and no decision will be made in executive session. This board meeting will adjourn at the end of the executive session, so we won't be back here in this room.